Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. ESG, or Environmental, Social, Governance, promises to help the bottom line and the planet at the same time. Is it too good to be true? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of an episode digging into that very question.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I think it amplifies, like, everything. So all the negatives are amplified and all of the positives are. Like, I wake up in the morning, the first thing that I do is check my phone to see who texted me.
And you go to bed?
I go to bed at night. Last thing I do is put down my phone.
It's always taking a chance, you know, playing with random people. Older guys, maybe in their 20s, who are, like, you know, a little bit creepy.
Well, that's from a podcast called Their Own Devices. And Mark Groman is the podcast co-host. In an earlier life, he was senior advisor for privacy in the Obama White House, chair of the Federal Privacy Council, and was also chief privacy officer at the U.S. Federal Trade Commission. And today, he teaches law at Georgetown University. Mark, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
So what are those kids in that clip we heard from your podcast just now? What were they talking about?
They were talking about how they use and engage with the online world and some of their own experiences, concerns, and risks that they perceive as kids and teenagers in an online world.
Yeah. So in those two voices, we heard the sort of totality of how much these kids are very online first thing in the morning and last thing at night. And even the young boy there saying that you're always taking a chance when you, let's say, play online games with people. Let's hear a little bit more, Mark, from your podcast. Here's a couple of kids talking about the impact of having a life immersed in the online world.
It was just this incessant buzzing of worthlessness that had kind of been filling my head for a few weeks. Messages, and just like couldn't get it out of my head. And I went there with the complete intention to try and kill myself that night.
You know, you have people like, I mean, kids being born now who are like growing up now into this Instagram. Like, we didn't really use Instagram when we were a lot younger. Like, I know I wasn't using it when I was 10 years old, but I know 10-year-olds that have Instagrams now. And I think that the age regulation should definitely be restricted.
So again, that's from Mark Groman's podcast, Their Own Devices. And what that young woman just said at the end of the cut, that's what we're going to talk about today, because there are some platform-specific restrictions out there. Those are determined by the companies. But what about federal law? So, Mark, when was the last time that federal law was updated regarding children's safety online?
Well, the primary federal law that addresses issues around children's privacy is called COPPA, the Children's Online Privacy Protection Act. That dates back to 1998, but fortunately in 2013, the Federal Trade Commission, which is the agency that is tasked with enforcing that law, they did update the rules and they did make some important changes to help address evolving risks that come from new technology. But that was 2013, and there's been some movement in states, but beyond those changes, it's status quo.
Okay, status quo, even as technology continues to advance at, you know, what feels like light speed. So let's go back in time a little bit. First of all, tell me, back in 1998, what triggered the passage of the Children's Online Privacy Protection Act? What was it intended to do back then, just before the turn of the millennium?
Well, we have to remember just how different the online world was back in 1998. In particular, we have to rewind and kind of put aside this entire mobile ecosystem that really is central to today's teen engagement. And it was much more about websites and fears around kids being stalked and tracked online that prompted some of the hearings and discussions and then led to the passage of COPPA by Congress. And importantly, the law is very high level, and then it tasks the Federal Trade Commission with implementing rules and regulations to provide more meat to the requirements and then to enforce those laws.
Okay. Mark, I'm going to presume that you're old enough to remember what 1998 was like. I certainly do.
I do, indeed. And I have a teenager now, And he still can't get his head around the fact that I went to high school without a cell phone. He just can't understand it.
He's like, how did you live? And yet you did survive. But the point is, I think the most important point you're making there is that was obviously a law designed for its time. And the major change, the biggest change, well, one of the biggest changes is it was pre-mobile. But those there were 2013 updates, right, which that came, let's say, 6 or 7 years after the introduction of the smartphone into the lives of humanities, into the lives of humanity, I should say. So, Mark, what did the FTC then modify or change about COPPA in 2013?
Well, one of the most important changes at that time was expanding or clarifying the definition of personal information to include things like geolocation, which for me is one of the key primary privacy issues online for teens and adults alike. And the rule also expanded to include things like a unique identifier or, a, for example, a cookie that can be used to track a device across sites or applications over time. And although that unique identifier, that string of numbers in and of itself may not be identifiable, the point is to link that with information about an individual or their device over time to create profiles. And so the FTC made it clear that that is covered by the rule.
Okay. But that, again, you're saying was 2013, so we're talking 8 years ago, going on 9 now. So if you were to name, and we'll get into this in much more detail throughout the rest of the program today, but if you were to name, or if you were to describe how far the FTC's current regulations are from where you think they need to be, how far would that distance be?
It's a pretty far distance at this time. And the role and scope of this rule and the law, it's very narrow. And so there are major gaps that need to be filled. And frankly, I'd like to say that I think that the United States needs a general privacy law that offers more robust protections for all Americans, not just children. And I'd like to see that passed. But to the extent that this Congress won't be able to pass a more general privacy law, and by the way, we are the only democracy in the world that does not have a federal or comprehensive privacy law, then I think it's incumbent upon our, you know, leaders and policymakers to at least address privacy as it relates to our children online, a topic that I've increasingly become passionate about.
Okay. Well, it seems as if your passions are beginning to be mirrored more overtly in Congress, because in October, as we all know, former Facebook employee Frances Haugen testified before Congress in the Facebook papers, and she testified that Facebook does indeed know that its products can be harmful to children, but the company continues to obfuscate around that fact. So that was back in October. And just last week, the Senate Commerce Subcommittee put Instagram CEO Adam Mosseri in the hot seat. Now, Instagram, of course, owned by Facebook as well. Now, Mosseri said there's no content on Instagram promoting self-harm. That's what he asserted. But Connecticut Senator Richard Blumenthal said that's not true. And Senator Blumenthal said, in fact, his staff had gone so far as to create a fake account for a young person and then did a little digging.
We have a teen account with all the protections on, the filters. We searched, quote, slit wrists, and the results, I don't feel I can describe in this hearing room. They are so graphic. That's within the past couple of days. I described to you an account that looked at eating disorders and attracted the same deluge of self-harm and anorexia coaches.
Senator Richard Blumenthal of Connecticut there. Here's Senator Mike Lee again in that same hearing talking about how he created an account, or his staff did, for a fictitious 13-year-old girl. And Senator Lee told Mosseri what Instagram offered up.
Instagram's top recommended account for a 13-year-old girl caused our explore page to go from showing really innocuous things like hairstyling videos to content that promotes body dysmorphia, sexualization of women, and content otherwise unsuitable for a 13-year-old girl. What happened?
Senator, eating disorder related content and eating disorders more broadly are a very complicated and difficult issue in society without...
And they're complicated enough without a social media site recommending it.
Senator Mike Lee of Utah. Now, the night before the Instagram CEO was to testify before that congressional committee, Instagram announced new safety features for children. Again, just the night before he was supposed to testify. Here's Senator Marsha Blackburn of Tennessee not buying it.
Yesterday at 3 a.m., which is midnight in the Silicon Valley, you released a list of product updates that you said would raise the standard for protecting teens and supporting parents online. And I'm not sure what hours you all keep in California, but where I'm from, the middle of the night is when you drop news that you don't want people to see. And maybe you thought that doing it in this manner would keep members of this subcommittee from seeing it right away and from raising concerns.
Senator Marsha Blackburn of Tennessee, in a congressional hearing just last week about child safety on the internet. Mark Grohman, what is behind this new surge of interest from Congress regarding children and online protections?
Well, I'd like to step back for just a moment, because there's one thing that I want to highlight, which is that in those hearings and even in this discussion, we are talking about a lot of different kinds of harms or potential problems for children. And it's really important that hopefully when our policymakers are talking about that, but when we talk about it with parents or the audience, that we sort of differentiate different kinds of concerns that I heard from the senators. Some of it is more related to content moderation and ensuring that the content that is provided is age appropriate and certainly not harmful. There are other concerns around data collection and privacy and default privacy settings and how data is then collected, processed, and used about our children. And then there are other concerns that range from screen time to online addiction or design elements in technology that are baked in to sort of keep our kids' eyeballs there. So there's a wide range of harms, and each of those require a specific tailored response.
Well, Mark, so stand by here. I'm really glad you brought that up, because I did actually intend on digging into each of those. And we'll do that when we come back after the break, and then also talk about whether Congress is equipped to really have that sort of multi-pronged attack as you're talking about. So we're talking about children and online safety this hour, and we'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. A recent episode featured a debate about ESG, or environmental social governance.
This sounds like more work than just putting your money into a social impact fund.
It's a lot more work.
Yeah.
Anybody who thinks there's an easy solution here is either engaged in puffery, greenwash, or deceiving themselves.
Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the episode.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're talking about children and online protections and where federal law needs to be to meet the modern day challenges that parents and families and kids themselves face when it comes to privacy and protection online. I'm joined today by Mark Grohman. He was the first chief privacy officer at the Federal Trade Commission. Today he teaches law at Georgetown University, and he's co-host of the podcast called Their Own Devices. And Mark, we're going to dig in a little bit more to the various types of protections that you talked about in a second. But I want to just listen to Gunesh Ajjar for a minute here. He's a professor at Radboud University in the Netherlands. And before that, he was at Princeton Center for Information Technology and Policy. And he took a close look at exactly what the platforms are doing.
Back in early 2019, there were complaints about YouTube serving behavioral advertisements to children or tracking children across websites. So the main goal of this small investigation was to look into how websites or advertisers such as Google complying with COPPA, the Child Online Privacy Protection Act. I have looked into websites that are targeted to children. These websites included, for example, website teaching Roman numerals, websites teaching like how to count or just play games.
So seemingly innocuous websites. But Ajjar explored what else children were being exposed to besides Roman numerals and games.
So I checked what kind of ads are there, what kind of advertisements are served on these websites. The reason is, Google should not be using behavioral advertisements on this website. So on YouTube, when a child watches a video that is clearly targeted to children, Google was serving behavioral advertisements along with content that is directly targeted to children.
And he describes the kinds of ads he found.
Some of the most shocking examples of these advertisements included ads containing malware, basically inviting children to click and install some malicious software on their computer. Ads that are highly inappropriate, such as Ashley Madison ads or some other dating ads. Advertisements for a meeting Qatari women specifically. And there was also behavioral advertisements or advertisements that track users on YouTube channels.
So, of course, you're wondering, was YouTube, which is owned by Google, following the Children's Online Privacy and Protection Act or not?
It turned out that Google had some mechanisms to filter out certain inappropriate ads from children's websites. But in those cases, these protections just failed.
That's Gunesh Ajjar, researcher at Radboud University in the Netherlands. So Gunesh there giving us an example of the kinds of things, at least regarding tracking and advertising that kids can be exposed to, even though the COPPA federal regulation exists. So Mark Grohman, now let me turn back to you here, because you did give us, rightfully, a whole suite of different kinds of areas of concern, whether content is age appropriate, the amount of data that's being collected by young users, what are default privacy settings, and are they adequate? Bigger questions about screen time and online addiction, and perhaps even the elements that are baked into the design of digital products that make them harder to put down. So let me ask you, does COPPA as it stands now even begin to address these varied, 2021 type concerns and needs when we're thinking about children's safety online?
Well, that's the rub. Absolutely not. And COPPA was never intended to address that diverse range of potential issues. And that's a very important point. Again, COPPA is a narrow law that is designed to address the collection and use of personal information from children under 13 in certain contexts. And that is the scope of the law, and that's all it is intended to do. And even in that case, there are certain gaps in the law or loopholes that can allow companies to get around some of those requirements. So in Congress today, if you want me to go there, there are proposals to sort of fix some of those. And one of the key issues is that if you are operating a website like YouTube, which is a general audience website, it's not just for kids under 13, you have to have actual knowledge that you have data from a child in order to fall within that law. And that is a really high standard, and it's one that is incredibly easy to evade in sort of today's online ecosystem.
So explain more about that. What do you mean?
So in other words, some websites are obviously designed for children and therefore within the law, and that's clear. But for most websites, for example, most social media sites, they are intended for adults and children under 13 alike. And so a company could avoid having to follow the law or COPPA by not knowing, not asking, or not finding out the age of users, and therefore they would not have actual knowledge that they're collecting data from children under 13 and then wouldn't face liability for that.
I see.
And so there's a proposal, one by, I believe, Senator Markey out there, that the standard should not be actual knowledge, but something more akin to constructive knowledge, where everything points to the fact that you are collecting data from millions and millions of children, as YouTube did, and therefore still covered by the law.
Okay, so age is kind of the bright line here. Can you talk about the other ways in which internet companies either get around determining the age of the end user, or that or ways in which it's actually hard for them to determine it, so therefore they feel like they don't have to be worried about COPPA?
Well, in certain contexts, it can be challenging to so-called age gate or determine the age of your users. But in many contexts, it's very common when you log in, create an account, use a website to provide a year or a date of birth. And in other ways, the companies do actually have knowledge. And so it's interesting that you mentioned YouTube earlier, which is owned by Google. Well, Google was, in fact, sued by the FTC for violating COPPA. They ultimately paid a $170 million fine. Notwithstanding earlier claims they weren't collecting data from children, they actually had evidence themselves that, in fact, they knew there were children under 13 on the site and that data was being collected from them. And so there are, you know, ways around it. But given today's advanced technology, the evolution of the ecosystem, the way that hyper-targeting and data collection algorithms and AI work, it can be done. And the question is, when it's difficult, who bears the responsibility or who bears the risk for that? Should it be the company, or should we be erring more on the side of protecting the kids?
So tell me about that. I mean, the way you phrased it kind of gives us the answer, your answer here, but I mean, the companies would say that if you and they have said before that overregulation would stifle the very kinds of innovation that have brought the, you know, the positive transformations that digital technology has introduced to all of us.
Well, look, that is a fair point, and there's validity to it in some respects. Look, I'm a techie. My house is wired to the hilt. I can't even count the devices in my home. And I have a 16-year-old, and he has more devices than the average person as well. And he's on social media. And so the benefits are astronomical. And I see that. And really what I want is not to say no technology or no digital environment, but here's how to reap all the benefits and minimize the harms. That's what we're all looking to do. But regulation, which is absolutely necessary, inherently could restrict some types of business models. It may slow down some innovation. But I would argue in this context, slowing things down as opposed to break things quickly or, you know, move quickly and break things might be a better approach when it comes to our kids' health, and our kids' digital well-being.
Yeah. So I want to take another step back here because, look, I'm not denying at all that technology and even social media have brought about a lot of positives, huge, unimaginable positives, even from the 2013 timeframe where the FTC last sort of adjusted its rules regarding COPPA. So I'm not a tech Luddite here. But I think we can also, and Mark, I know you agree with this. I'm just kind of stating this for the sake of the conversation, that we've also come to a point where things just don't feel right, right? And there's this like intuitive sense that when kids start up their devices at any time now in this day and age, they're taking a risk. Whether it be, again, being exposed to age-inappropriate content, losing their, you know, any control over their privacy, it just feels like it's much more overwhelming and much more risky than individuals or individual families can reasonably manage. I mean, is that fair to say?
It is fair to say. I mean, even as an expert, I find it incredibly challenging to keep up with the changes that are made on individual platforms, the innovations that are being made in specific apps, the new apps that are constantly being, you know, being downloaded and used. And so even for myself, at one point in time, I may approve and say, great, go use this app. And then a new feature is added that I'm not aware of that had I known, I might have made a different decision or at least counseled my kid slightly differently. And so it's really difficult. Now, I do want to say that before we start attacking Silicon Valley or tech companies, I do passionately believe there's an important role for parents here. As difficult as it is, parents absolutely have to engage. And so I don't want to just jump past that. And I want to reiterate that, but it's too difficult. And so what I would like to see are common sense rules and laws put in place that address applications and platforms and sites and services directed to kids. Certainly, I think that updating COPPA makes sense. The age 13 is completely arbitrary.
Yeah.
And so I know that's up for debate, but I would suggest that, you know, 12 and under is probably too low and that our laws ought to extend to a higher age. We could debate what that should be, but the age set of COPPA strikes me as too low. And I know that in our discussions with teenagers, that 13, 14 age is particularly challenging, right? That eighth grade middle school is a really high risk age for kids. And so that 13 age doesn't necessarily feel right to me.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, in Europe, there are laws and, in fact, guidance that have been put out in the last year from regulators in the United Kingdom and Ireland, specifically about how to design technology and services for kids with the well-being of kids in mind,
right,
and not just the bottom line or the profit or the engagement for the children.
So I'm going to pause you right there because we're actually going to talk about that because we have a voice from the United Kingdom in a couple of minutes here. But just to share a little story here, like the other day, I have a little person in my house who was using a online typing tutorial, right? Like, you know,
right,
what I'm talking about, because he's trying to learn how to type. And it seemed very, very innocent. So for like a heartbeat, I turn around. I'm like, fine, do the little online typing game. And then I turn back around and like I was looking. First of all, I have an ad blocker, so I don't know how these things got around the ad blocker. But there was not really delightful ads shot through this website. So I was like, oh God, I gotta find a stronger ad blocker now. So it's just very, very, very hard for parents to keep up. But I want to turn the attention, before we look to other solutions and what to learn from them, I do want to turn the attention right back on the United States federal government. Because as you said earlier, it's the FTC that is in charge of enforcement and update of COPPA. And you were at the FTC beforehand. I mean, has the commission been doing enough over time from 1998 to 2013 to now to actually enforce the law that it has on the books?
Well, I think that the FTC has done an admirable job actually enforcing the law it has. Again, the FTC can update rules, but the FTC cannot modify the actual statute as passed by Congress. And so any rule update is limited to the authority they were given by Congress in the confines of the statute. And so I think that the rule modifications in 13 were actually well executed and well done. And I think the FTC has done, given the FTC's current resources, a fairly good job enforcing it. In fact, just this past week, they announced a fairly high-profile COPPA case against an ad network for violating COPPA that I think will send an interesting message to the ad ecosystem about their responsibility for understanding when they're collecting data from applications that are targeting kids. Mm. So I think they've done an okay job with the tools that they currently have, but it's Congress that must act.
Part and parcel of a fundamental gap we have here in the United States between the speed at which technology is moving and the sort of lumbering pace at which regulation and Congress can move? I mean, are we going to forever have that gap, or could the FTC more regularly, maybe even annually, update their rules so that we don't go almost a decade between times where we're taking a look again seriously at children's safety online?
Well, given the FTC's current resources and current statutory authority, that would not be the optimal way to go. Maybe they could do more in terms of updating rules, or in fact, the FTC has just announced that they intend to do a rulemaking related to children's privacy issues that could take a couple of years to ultimately implement. But it's a cumbersome process. And again, it's limited by the FTC's authority as a consumer protection agency and the rules they have. It would leave a lot of gaps. And I think the better approach would be for Congress to act, pass a comprehensive privacy law that addresses all Americans, or if not that, then a law that updates our laws with respect to children and how companies and services online interact with and engage with kids.
Well, so we have just 30 seconds before the next break here, Mark. You heard a little earlier some sound from last week's congressional hearing. It's not the first one we've had in recent memory about children and online privacy or protections. Do you feel like what seems to be bipartisan consensus around this now could actually lead to the kinds of changes that you're calling for?
I'm not optimistic, unfortunately. I worked in Congress in 2008 on the Energy and Commerce Committee in the House. We had similar hearings. The bipartisan gridlock in Washington doesn't bode well for effective, real change to protect our kids.
Even when Senators Lee and Blackburn and Blumenthal are all singing from the same hymnal on this one, you still
they're singing from the same hymnal when they read the title of the song. But when it comes down to the notes and the details, that's when the disagreements start and they can't seem to agree.
Well, we'll have a lot more when we come back. So, Mark Roman, stand by. This is On Point.
Three decades ago, Sterling Cunha was an angry, violent teenager facing life without parole. Today, he's a celebrated author and a peacemaker. His journey is a window into how violence is perpetuated in this country. But it's also a story about how people change.
There's no better example of a person who's prepared to be released.
And about people changing the system.
We have to reimagine what we're doing, because what we're doing isn't working.
This is Cell Blocks to Mountaintops, a podcast and video series. Subscribe now wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, On Point listeners. I'm poet and author Xinyi Pai. As you celebrate Asian American Pacific Islander Heritage Month, I invite you to listen to the 10,000 Things podcast from KUOW and the NPR Network. 10,000 Things is a podcast about modern artifacts of Asian American life, ordinary objects that tell extraordinary stories and reveal something profound about the experience of being Asian in America. Find 10,000 Things from KUOW and the NPR Network, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Tomorrow on the show, we're going to be talking about the rise in labor union participation seen in the United States this year, an increase in the number of strikes and union drives, and a level of overall public support for unions not seen since 1965 in the United States. So we want to hear from you. If you're a worker whose workplace either unionized or had a union drive this year, or you want to have one, how is that going? How did that go? What prompted it? If you're an employer or a business owner that's seen a union drive in your business, what was that like? What did it open your eyes to regarding the desires of your workers? What was the outcome? Tell us your stories at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. That's for tomorrow's show. Today, we are talking about why Congress hasn't meaningfully updated the actual law regarding children and online privacy and protection in quite some time, and whether or not the tide is turning on that. I'm joined today by Mark Groman. He's a former senior advisor for privacy in the Obama White House, was the first chief privacy officer at the FTC. He now teaches law at Georgetown University and is co-host of the terrific podcast called Their Own Devices. And Mark, hang on with me for just another second or two here, because I want to remind folks about why there seems to be increased interest in Congress about kids and online safety. Because, again, as we mentioned, last October, just a couple of months ago, Frances Haugen, former Facebook employee, testified on Capitol Hill. And here is an exchange Haugen had with Connecticut Senator Richard Blumenthal on how Haugen says Facebook turns a blind eye to how addictive Instagram can be for children.
Facebook knows that its amplification algorithms, things like engagement-based ranking on Instagram, can lead children from very innocuous topics like healthy recipes to anorexia-promoting content over a very short period of time.
And has Facebook ever found, again, in its research, that kids show sign of addiction on Instagram?
Facebook has studied a pattern that they call problematic use, what we might more commonly call addiction. It has a very high bar for what it believes it is. It says you self-identify that you don't have control over your usage and that it is materially harming your health, your schoolwork, or your physical health. 5 to 6% of 14-year-olds have the self-awareness to admit both those questions. It is likely that far more than 5 to 6% of 14-year-olds are addicted to Instagram.
So that was from October. Well, last week there were hearings on Instagram, and Senator Blumenthal asked CEO Adam Mosseri whether new regulations that went into effect in Britain in September, we'll hear more about those in just a minute, they might, if those regulations might help prevent addictive online behavior in teens. But Adam Mosseri, again, CEO of Instagram, denied that addictive behavior is a problem.
Instagram is addictive. That's the view that has been repeated again and again and again by people who are expert in this field. Parents know it, and the UK code legally restricts its use of addictive designs. Shouldn't we have a similar rule in the United States?
Senator, respectfully, I don't believe the research suggests that our products are addictive. Research actually shows that on 11 of 12 difficult issues that teens face, teens are struggling, said Instagram helps more than harms.
We can debate the meaning of the word addictive, but the fact is that teens who go to the platform find it difficult, maybe sometimes impossible, to stop.
Senator Richard Blumenthal and Instagram head Adam Mosseri in a congressional hearing just last week. Okay, so this new code out of the United Kingdom regarding kids and online safety. Well, what is it? Britain did just institute a new set of rules that tech companies have to adhere to if they want to reach kids in the UK. So Sonia Livingston is a professor at the London School of Economics who studies children's digital rights.
In September, the age-appropriate design code came into force in Britain. It's part of our Data Protection Act. And the way we did it was to articulate what's really important about children. So we've kind of brought together child rights and data protection in one really simple code. And it has 15 standards that all online services that are likely to be accessed by children have to follow. And it means that what children need and what's right for children is now being implemented by digital companies in a way that they hadn't ever done before.
And how did the big tech companies respond?
It really took effect in September this year, September 2021, and we could see from the kind of months running up and especially the weeks running up to that and just after, it was like companies really began to notice and they suddenly started making the changes that the code required. And I think interesting for folks around the world, it has also meant that it was kind of more efficient, more expedient for companies to kind of roll out the code generally rather than make it apply just in Britain.
And Professor Livingston says there have already been major improvements.
things are already better and they are getting better. So we saw Instagram announce that it would stop unknown adults directly messaging children under 18s. We saw TikTok saying that those under 16 would have their accounts set to private by default. We saw Google stop targeted advertising to under 18s, kind of taking children right out of their business model and introducing safe search by default. We saw YouTube remove autoplay to stop children being kind of fed endless videos in a way that they found difficult to stop. And we've also seen lots of well-being features, lots of kind of time out and take a break features being introduced by a number of different services. So yeah, a number of really significant changes, I think.
And the UK's new rules are, in fact, attracting attention from other governments.
I'm certainly hearing from the States, from a whole host of countries in Europe and Canada, all kinds of places, that governments are looking at the code and thinking, can we pass a similar law? It's clear that we're seeing, you know, one after the next series of changes that are benefiting children. And that's amazing.
That was Professor Sonia Livingston. She specializes in children's digital rights at the London School of Economics. Okay, Mark, so do you think that, first of all, what's your evaluation of what the United Kingdom has done? Is that a model that the U.S. ought to follow?
So the first thing I'll say is that Sonia Livingston is just a preeminent leader in this space. I want to quibble with one statement she said, and this will in part answer your question, which is that she said the code is simple. It's not simple. It's actually quite complex, and it is in many respects rooted in the European legal framework of their laws and certain of the European fundamental rights that don't translate neatly or one for one into sort of the American legal framework. And there are about 15 principles within the code and requirements about how they should be implemented. Now, that said, the examples that she gave of those changes, those are exactly the kinds of changes that we need to see here in the United States. And so that is incredible progress in a fairly short amount of time based on the code. The aspects of the code that I think that we need to really look at closely are things that she mentioned, like privacy defaults and privacy by design. That is, if you are offering a service to children 16 and under, the default should be that the data is not shared publicly. The default should be that data isn't collected. The default should be that we're not tracking your location, and that an individual has to take a step to allow that or to enable those features rather than shut them off. And so changes like that are incredibly positive and really important. And so I do think we should look at those kinds of things about ensuring that privacy features are baked in, changing defaults and how data is collected at services towards children. What she mentioned about TikTok and I think it was with autoplay.
A YouTube autoplay. Mm-hmm.
Right. That should also be disabled by default when it's a service for children so that the default is you see one video and they don't continue playing unless somebody activates or makes an affirmative change. That is exactly the direction we need tech companies to go. And I applaud that effort. I don't know that it would map perfectly. Mm-hmm. There are elements of it that, quite frankly, I think are difficult to apply when you're trying to base technology on, say, best interests of a child. It's a tough standard, but there's a lot there that other countries, including the United States, should look to for not a perfect model, but examples of better things we can do for our kids.
You know, the lesson that I take from all of this is, you know, your point about whether in terms of policy instrumentation that it can't map one-to-one here in the United States. I understand that. But from, you know, the speed with which the tech companies acted when the UK's new rules came about in September, and then even more broadly when the European Union a long while ago put into place the new their overall privacy rules regarding privacy in the internet. And then here's a third example, just basically anything that in China, anything the Chinese government wants, the internet companies will automatically do because they want access to the Chinese market. The lesson that I take from all three of those examples is they will do it. we just have to tell them. Yeah, they can do it no matter what they say. They can. And we just have the government of the United States simply must require it.
And that's an important point. For example, every decision in technology, right, by these companies, nothing is accidental. So I personally shy away from the word addiction. I think it is a little bit loaded. But there's no question that all of these platforms are built with features that are designed to keep our children engaged for as long as possible, because the ad model, the revenue model, hinges on that. And so any feature that can keep a kid engaged and prevent them or discourage them from switching to another service or shutting down, that's baked in. And we know that. Similarly, when a company has an incentive to direct someone to do something like the purchase funnel to get you to go through and close a purchase and make a sale, companies know exactly how to design that and the font colors that make sense and the size of the font and where on a page to put things. And so that nothing's accidental. And so we should take those same lessons and in the context of our children require different outcomes and different behaviors. And that's exactly what the UK is getting at here, that they call them, I think, nudge features, where there are features on websites that nudge you to take certain actions, nudge you to provide more data, nudge you to, stay engaged online. We can debate whether that's appropriate for adults or not, but certainly for kids and adolescents, it's not. And so that's where I would really like to see those changes made and follow suit with some of the recommendations out of the UK.
Yeah. Well, we're getting quite a few comments online here. Ferna says kids are being given devices in school, especially with COVID, but aren't being taught how to use them safely. Schools just don't have the expertise or knowledge at local levels to keep them safe. And then Ben Grimm says, where are the parents? Phones and websites have kid safety features and parents must be on, must overwatch. The internet should be treated like a pool. Every time the kids are in it, a parent must be a lifeguard. No number of laws can substitute this. And Ben, as a parent, I 50% agree with you. Of course, parents have to have, must have a sense of personal responsibility in terms of monitoring, protecting, and guiding their children's online use. But your pool analogy is really interesting because, sure, if we're using a neighbor's backyard pool, a parent should be watching there. But what about community pools? We have laws with community pools about having to have lifeguards there in addition to parents. And I think that's kind of where the analogy works with the internet safety and the federal government's role here. So, Mark, let me, in the last 2 minutes that we have, I want to talk about a practical thing that I don't, may or may not end up going through Congress. But we do have the Kids Act, or the Kids Internet Design and Safety Act, co-sponsored by Senators Ed Markey and Richard Blumenthal and Representative Kathy Castor from Florida. It has a lot of the actionable factors that we just talked about. Do you think that they're on the right track, and does it have a hope in heck of getting through Congress?
Well, it's certainly on the right track. It addresses many of the issues that we talked about, which is what is the age that this should be set at? Is it 13 or is it something higher? It addresses some of the gaps or loopholes that are in COPPA today around actual knowledge, which allows companies to often evade liability. And in many cases, it talks about Bill of Rights or enhancing the resources of the Federal Trade Commission to address these very issues. And in some cases, we didn't talk about this, but I'm very passionate about the issue around the collection and use of location data generally, but in particular with our children. Mm-hmm. And so I'd like to see it really focus on when and how precise location data is collected about and from our kids.
Is that in the Kids Act?
I don't recall specifically, okay. But it's certainly geolocation is treated as a more sensitive category. And so there are additional restrictions around it. I just don't recall the specifics.
Okay. So I didn't mean to interrupt your flow there. Do you think that that there's any reason to hope that, you know, perhaps the bill, not as it's written word for word now, but some form of this may, and we just got 30 seconds, may actually make it through?
I think that some form of this can make it through. There are political issues that are holding things up around private rights of action and preemption and the like. But on substance around our children, I think that our policymakers agree that enough hasn't been done, and it's time for our policymakers and leaders to step up and protect kids online.
Well, Mark Grohman, co-host of the podcast Their Own Devices, currently teaches law as well at Georgetown University. Thank you so much for joining us today, Mark.
Pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes.
Can profit motive save the planet? Is a company that takes the climate into account a better investment? How about one that pays workers a living wage and champions transparency and board diversity? That's the idea of ESG, or environmental social governance.
Sounds like a wonderful story. You can make more money, you can save the planet at the same time. Almost no one is going to turn that down.
It's a story that Andy King of Questrom and Veet Henish of the Wharton School challenged during a recent event at Questrom. Professor King played the critic, who says these are problems for regulation to solve, not markets.
As a famous economist said to me, you can't fix externalities with the profit motive, because the profit motive is not linked to externalities. Externalities are the byproduct of pursuing profits. So you can't fix them by getting people to even look harder at profits.
Meanwhile, Veet emphasized that ESG can be an important part of the solution.
Regulation matters, and we need better regulation. And we need to reallocate trillions of dollars of capital over time to the climate transition alone, forgetting social justice, racial justice, and other ESG issues. We're going to need the profit motive for that. No government regulation is going to reallocate tens of trillions of dollars of capital alone. It's going to be investors who are looking at current government regulation and future government regulation and trying to connect the dots.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.